Good evening, I'm Lee Hay, and welcome to a celebration of King Records tonight. The spotlight's on Hank Ballard and the Midnighters, who recorded many hits for King, including Finger Poppin' Time, Sugar Ree, and Thrill on the Hill. Two of the remaining Midnighters, Billy Davis and Norman Thrasher, recently shared some of their memories of those days with music historian Brian Powers. This evening, you'll also hear songs they recorded at King Records on this special in honor of King Records Month in Cincinnati.
Tonight, my guest is Billy Davis, who is the guitar player for Hank Ballard and the Midnighters. We got him on the phone up in Detroit. Billy, thank you very much for taking some time to talk to us about your time with the Midnighters.
Thank you. It's a pleasure because the Midnighters was the most exciting part of my entire life.
As I understand, you grew up in Detroit, but originally you were born in Memphis?
No, originally I was born in Mississippi, but I moved to Memphis when I was about 4 years old.
How did you end up in Detroit?
Well, we went to Memphis, and when I was about 4, I started the school there in the first grade. But then my family moved back to Mississippi, and around 1946, moved back to Mississippi, and we stayed there until 1951, and then moved to Detroit and been there ever since.
What brought your family to Detroit?
My father was looking for a job, and the oil industry was real popular at that time. And left and came up from Belzona, Mississippi to Detroit.
So how old were you when you moved to Detroit?
I was 13.
And I'm assuming you were already into music at that time.
No, I sure wasn't. I wished I was. It was just a dream of mine to get into music.
What kind of music were you listening to growing up?
Blues and country, mostly. That's where my heart was at. I loved the blues. People like Elmore James, Arthur Big Boy Cruder, Muddy Waters, Hank Williams. And people like that. That's what I grew up with.
And how did you get into playing guitar?
Well, I used to go to the movie every Saturday when I was in Mississippi, and I would see cowboys like Roy Rogers, Gene Autry, Tex Ritter. The guy with the big, beautiful guitar, and just something about the instrument really just fascinated me. I loved the sound of it and the looks of it. It was just like a dream. I mean, I wanted to get my hands on one. I wanted to learn how to play one. That was my biggest information, seeing people like that, you know, Gene Autry, Roy Rogers, Tex Ritter, you know, guy with the big, pretty guitars, you know.
So how did you get your first guitar?
When I was 15 years old, going on 16, and I had a cousin. He was a friend of John B. Hooker's, and he had an acoustic guitar. And I had met this Brian guy. He was lived right around the corner from me. And I had asked him, would he teach me how to play? He said, yeah, I'll show you what I know. My cousin loaned me his acoustic guitar to learn. And I would go around to this blind guy's house each day, and he would start me out on a little small acoustic guitar. And, you know, a few years later, my mother co-signed for me to get a electric guitar.
And how old were you when you started playing in a band in front of an audience?
Oh, I was about 17. I formed my own band, which I patterned after Bill Haley in the comics, so I call them Billy Davis and the Upsetters.
Oh, right, the Upsetters.
That predated my time with Hank Ballard. I had that group together for about a few years.
Now, Detroit at that time, there were a lot of bands coming out of Detroit in the 50s. What was the scene like when you were playing with the Upsetters?
Oh, the scene, it was very, very exciting. There was a lot of people playing. I mean, you know, like Junior Walking All-Stars, people like that. But he wasn't known as at that particular time. And there was a lot of blues guitar players around at the time, blues bands mostly. And my band, the Upsetter, we played a little bit of everything. We were different than the average group because we played country and rhythm and blues, rock and roll.
Now, was Hank Ballard and the Midnighters, were they playing on the same circuits, same places that you guys were playing?
No, I sure didn't. The way I met Hank Ballard and the Midnighters, they were in a totally different category than we were. And I was playing at a place in Detroit called the East Side Show Bar. And I was playing there from Wednesday through Sunday. And there was a guy that knew a lot of the, you know, recording stars. So he brought one of the Midnighters in to see us because we were the hottest group in Detroit at the time. And the singer of the Midnighters, and that was Henry Booth. he brought him in, and he sit in with my group. Then he asked me, just about closing time, he asked me, he said, man, he said, I love the way you play, and when Hank Ballard's looking for a guitar player, he said, would you be interested? And I said, oh, yeah, man, yeah, you know. But I didn't take him serious. I thought he was just pulling my leg. I didn't believe it at all. But that's how it started, because he was serious.
So did you audition for Hank Ballard?
Yeah, I auditioned because Henry, after I told him I was interested, so he said, okay, I'll let Hank Ballard know when I get back to the hotel. They were staying at the hotel. And the next day he called me. He said, man, he said, well, can you come to rehearsal today, which was on a Monday? I said, yeah. They were staying at the Gotham Hotel. He said, well, we'll pick you up. You know, so they came, picked me up, took me to rehearsal, and I went in and had no problem at all with the audition because that was my favorite group. I knew just about all of their songs anyway. So that was the easiest audition I ever had because songs like Work With Me, Annie Had a Baby, Sexy Ways, I had been playing those all the time.
This is about, what, 1958 or 59, I think?
Right, 58 going into 59.
And how old were you at that point?
19 going on 20.
So you were kind of like the young guy in the group.
Oh, yeah. They used to call me the baby midnighter because I was the youngest of all of them. At the time, Hank was only about 28, 29, something like that. I was the novelty of the group because that's what started the young girls. Hank Ballard said, well, he said, you done caused us to have a lot of young fans, you know, and because a lot of the teenage fans, they started fan clubs popping up. And Hank said it was because of me, because I was so young looking, you know, because most of their followers at that time was in the recently 20s, early 30s.
Now, did you guys have to dress a certain way, or did you have certain rules on stage that he wanted you to follow or anything?
Oh, yeah, well, he had dress codes. But for his stage presence, he let me do my own thing, because I was such an exciting guitar player, doing all the stunt choreography and flips and all that stuff. He would feature me for 30 minutes with them. You know, I'd go out with the band and play for 30, do my own set for 30 minutes, then come off, change clothes, then go back out with them, you know.
What kind of guitar were you playing?
At that time, I was playing a Les Paul Junior.
Do you remember the first show that you played with the Midnighters?
I sure do. The first show I played was in Springfield, Massachusetts. I can't think of the name of the place, but it was a nice big place.
Can you describe what a typical show would be like?
They were the most beautiful women I had ever seen in my life. I thought I had seen some when I was here. It was just like being in paradise. I couldn't believe it. I mean, every place we go, we saw young, beautiful women coming to the shows. You know? That's who followed us all over the country.
How were you guys traveling? You guys didn't have a bus at that time, did you?
No, we didn't have a bus at the time. Hank Ballard had two Cadillacs. He had a black and white Coupe de Ville and a red and white Coupe de Ville, and had a Plymouth station wagon.
How many guys were on the road?
Well, there were three Midnighters besides myself. Three Midnighters, Hank Ballard, and me. That's five. And the band had a trumpet and sax player, bass, drums, and piano. So it was about 10 of us all together, plus Hank's valet, about 11 people on the road at the time.
Were you guys on any of those package tours, you know, where you had other artists on the bill?
Yeah, every year, at least 2-3 times a year, we'd be on the show with sometime 11 acts. Jackie Wilson and Sam Cooke were the most of the headline, most of those shows, Jackie Wilson, Sam Cooke, and Hank Ballard and the Midnighters. When we worked a show with them, one of them would be the headliner, and we would come in after, you know, Sam Cooke or Jackie Wilson.
And were you playing, like, in theaters for those kind of shows?
No, we played mostly auditoriums. Now, we did theaters like the Apollo in New York City, the Regal in Chicago, the Royal in Baltimore, Maryland, and the Howard in Washington, D.C. It would be a package show, though, but wouldn't be traveling on the road. Sometimes B.B. King would put us on some of the Apollo theater shows and stuff like that.
Yeah, you met a lot of people on the road, right? You met Elvis Presley, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, Elvis Presley had two state troopers to come escort us from Crump Stadium in Memphis, Tennessee, to Graceland, and when he got discharged from the Army.
You kind of had sideburns. If you had a little bit of like an Elvis look back then, or I think you still kind of do, don't you?
Yeah, well, that's what the girls used to call me. But they called me the Black Elvis.
Wait, and did you say that you went to Graceland?
Oh, yeah, 1960. When we got there, It was so crowded, and we had to go to Texas the next day. We really didn't get a chance to meet him then. Hank Ballard said, oh, man, we'll never get a chance to meet him at this thing. We got to be in Houston, Texas tomorrow, you know. So we had to leave. So I didn't really get a chance to meet him until about 1973 when I was playing with Jackie Wilson.
Now, you met a young teenager, I think, from Seattle when you were on the road one time, right?
Oh, a guy named James Hendricks, and I almost didn't meet him because we had did a show at the time in Seattle. It was a theater there would be the same as the Apollo in New York. It was called the Eagle Auditorium. And we had did one show, and we was taking an intermission. We was all in the back, and the trumpet player named Pat Patterson, he went up front. And he came back a little while. He said, there's a guy out here want to meet you. You say he wanted me to get top player, which I said, oh. I said, man, I ain't got time to meet no guy. I'm trying to find me a girl for the night, you know. He said, well, okay. And then he left, and he came back. He said, man, come meet this guy. Every time he see me, he's bugging me, want to meet you, you know. So that happened three times. The third time, he was really mad. And I said, okay, well, I'll go meet him, you know. So I went and met him and opened the backstage door, and there he stood, you know, big smile on his face. And when he saw me, and, you know, I shook his hand and invited him to come in. And he smiled right away, asking me about the guitar. What, how you do this? What, you know? And I spent a lot of time with him, and I told him, I said, well, I said, you can stay, you know, most everybody is glad to go up for the show. I said, but you want to stay with me? You know, he said, yeah. So he stayed. We stayed together and spent a lot of time. And before he left, yeah, he asked me would I come by his house and meet his dad. I said, yeah, you know, because we was in the area for at least about 10 days. And that's why I got a chance to really know him really good. And I showed him a lot of stuff on the guitar, and he was, ooh, I mean, it was just it's constantly. And that relationship lasted up until he died in 1970. I had no idea he would become as great as he was, you know. But one thing, because he didn't impress me at all the way he played, but what impressed me was his determination. But I would show him different stuff like that, and he just was determined and he wanted to have it perfect. He didn't want to just learn it. He was a perfectionist.
You were one of the early people doing the wah-wah pedal.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, Fender gave me a wah-wah pedal. See, it's like Leo Fender gave me my first Stratocaster. And they gave me that to experiment, you know. And I was playing it. I didn't see anyone else doing it. And a few years later, that I seen people recording with, you know, and I was with Higher Records at the time. Willie Mitchell was the producer down there, the one that produced all the big hits on Al Green. So I took it to him. I said, man, I said, let me use this. I said, this is something nobody's doing it, you know. He said, no, man, that's not the Memphis sounds, and we can't use that. I said, no kidding. I said, this is going to be big. No, he said, we got to stick with the Memphis sound. He wouldn't do it. And all of a sudden, Isaac Hayes come out with Shaft, and just about everybody else was up, you know. So I took it to B.B. King. He was playing at the Village Gate. I said, B.B., try this, man. This is something, you know, so I said, the record company won't let me use it. And we all know what happened with it. It became the biggest craze out there.
Well, I want to talk a little about some of the recordings you did with the Midnighters at the King Studios in Cincinnati.
1540 Brewster Street.
Yes. I think your very first session, I think you recorded Sugary.
Oh, yeah, I sure did. Yeah. Marty Robbins wrote that. You know, he was a country singer. He wrote it especially for Hank Ballard. Sugary, sugary. Sugary, sugary. I got a letter from my baby. She says she's coming home today. I got a letter from my baby. She says she's coming home today. Oh, well, my baby wasn't lying.
Was that your first recording with the Midnighters?
No, that wasn't the first one. The very first one was a song called Rain Down Tears. It wasn't a hit, but I remember that being the first, very first one that we recorded. It was kind of like a parody of Teardrops on Your Letter. You say you're leaving, ain't coming back. Nothing I can tell you to make you unpack, but it's gonna rain.
Did Henry Glover work on any of your sessions? I know he left near the end of 59.
Right, most all of them. Henry Glover, Gene Reed.
When you were at the King Studios, would you use a lot of the studio musicians that King had?
Only if some of the guys didn't show up, we would use Philip Paul on drums because we had a drummer out at the time. His name was George DeHart. And he was having trouble. He was an older guy. In fact, he was older than Hank. He was the oldest guy in the band. And he got so his timing was off, so couldn't use him. So we started using Philip Paul.
Were you guys pretty prepared with your material on these sessions? Or did you just try to, when you showed up, you kind of would work out some arrangements?
Well, Hank Ballard and myself, we would do the arrangements. And what happened, it's like the biggest hits, we didn't spend that much time. Because we went in and did an album. And we was on the way out. We was loading up the station wagon, getting ready to leave. And Hank told me, he said, Billy, get your guitar, you know. And I said, okay. So I got the guitar, went over there. He had a pencil and a piece of paper. He was saying, he said, have a drill up on the... He was saying that. And then he said, see what you can put with this, you know. You need to give me an introduction, you know. And Sid Nathan just happened to be listening. He said, what is that, you know. Hank said, oh, so that's an idea I got. Sid said, get those guys back in here. Let's record this. And so, hey, we got the guys back in and said, man, this, and I had to show them the introduction and show them how, you know. And we recorded, and, you know, at the time, King had their own pressing plant. The next week, we were riding somewhere, and we heard it on the radio just that fast.
And that was a big hit for you guys.
That was a real, real big hit. Finger popping time, Hank, we got the idea. We was in a restaurant and a lady come in and somebody say, what's going on, so and so? Yeah. You know, oh man, it's finger popping time. Hank grabbed a piece of paper. Man, did you hear that? I said, what you mean? He said, did you hear that? She said, it's finger popping. That's the name of a song. That's a song, you know. So he started writing. And we went back to the hotel. He said, man, get your guitar, come to my room. We gonna get this, you know. So we did it and the next day, we went and recorded that one. Hey now, hey now, hey now, hey now, it's finger popping time. Finger popping time. I feel so good. Woo! And that's a real good sign. Hey now, hey.
And you had three big pop hits in 1960. You had Finger Popping Time, Let's Go, Let's Go, and you had The Twist.
Right. That was the first time that it ever happened to have three records at the same time, like then consecutively.
And then you guys did some TV appearances. I think you guys showed up on the Dick Clark Show at one point, right?
Yeah, but something happened with that. To this very day, I never knew what happened. But we flew up from Atlanta, Georgia. We was appearing at the Royal Peacock Club in Atlanta, Georgia. And we flew up to Philadelphia to do, you know, American Bandstand. And Hank Ballard and Dick Clark got into a verbal confrontation, and they was in a different room from where we were, but we could hear it. Profanity was going on, and Hank Ballard come back. He said, man, come on, let's go. He said, man, we ain't did the show, man. He said, well, no, we ain't gonna do that. We going back to Atlanta, you know. But he never told us why. And less than a year later, we heard Chevy Checker singing The Twist. First time I ever heard Chevy Checker sing The Twist was when we was on the way to Miami. The driver, we had a driver, his name was Cleveland Murray. He was driving. And I'm in the station where I all of a sudden wakes up. I hear Twist, and I said it sounded like us, but I knew it wasn't us. And when we listened at it, everybody got quiet. And when after the player could play, the disc jockey said Chubby Checker, and everybody said, "Who in the hell is Chubby Checker?" You know, so that was the first time I'd ever heard the Twist other than the one that we did. Come on, baby, let's do the Twist. Come on.
Round and round, baby, round and round. Well, how did you guys feel about Chubby Checker? I guess Hank, he was probably getting some song royalties from all that.
We was playing at the Uptown Theater in Philadelphia, and Chubby Checker came by. His twist was hot. He came by to meet Hank Ballin in the midnight. And Hank turned his back on him. Hank wouldn't talk to him. We was getting ready to go on stage. Then he tried to talk to some of the other guys in the group, and they wouldn't talk to him, you know. Then he came to me. He said, man, I'm trying to talk to Hank Ballin. Hank Ballin won't talk to me. I said, there ain't nothing I can do about it. Just like he wanted me to say something to Hank, but I said, what can I do? You know, if he don't want to talk to you, I can't make it. And Hank never did talk to him at that particular time. Years later, they become, but at this particular time when the twist first came out, he didn't.
But you guys did some other dance. You guys were doing the Continental Walk.
His name was Don Covey. He wrote that.
You had several different dance songs, didn't you?
Yeah, the Switcheroo, the Float. One of Sid Nathan's relatives wrote the Float.
Yeah, like a 12-year-old kid, I think, wasn't it?
Right, exactly. Hank didn't really want to do it. He did it to please Sid, you know.
I think that actually went on the charts for a bit.
It sure did. So much. But I thought it was a joke. Hank did too. But it sold.
I'm a spaceman sent from the moon. Shot of a missile and heard this tune. Let's go.
Didn't you guys do a session with Little Willie John?
Sure did. Little Willie John just happened to be in the studio when we was went in to do an album. And they start talking and say, hey, won't you and Little Willie do something together? Oh, yeah, that's a good idea. And Willie was looking for Freddie Jordan. Freddie Jordan was a studio musician, guitar player, who played on most all Willie's stuff, but Freddie wasn't there. He asked me what I play. I said, oh, yeah, no problem. That's, you know, that's the only one I play with Willie John. I'd like to see my baby walking down the avenue. I'd like to see my baby walking down the avenue. I'm like, yeah.
Was that something that you guys wrote up for that session, or was that something that was already written?
I think Hank and Willie came up with that themselves. There was a chance to do it, and they just wanted to get it done, and they quickly come up with that song. I don't know if it's Hank's idea or Willie's. I think it was Willie's, though.
So do you have a particular recording that you did with the Midnighters that you're proud of, that you're happy with the sound?
Well, one of them is A Look at Little Sister. I think that's the most one, because we was playing in Portland, Oregon, and there were some college kids had chartered a bus, and they came to the dressing room. They said they wanted to meet me. They said, well, we wanted to know, were you playing on the solo you did on the song, because if you had a sound, I didn't know what they were talking about. They said, sound like you had hit a note like a violin or something. I told them, I said, well, I didn't use nothing. I just used my guitar. They wanted to see me do it in person. We wanted to see what were you using to get the, you know. And at that time, that's when I had switched from the Les Paul Jr. to the Stratocaster, given to me by Leo Fender in 1959.
Well, I had a couple of questions about the King Studios. What do you remember how that studio was set up, the quality and stuff?
Well, it really never looked like a big, high-quality studio to me. It didn't. There were a lot of them that looked much better inside, you know. But it was kind of old-fashioned, in a sense. Wasn't what I would say a top-quality studio. You know? Even though it come out with some great stuff, it didn't seem like they had the top-quality equipment. But I guess it was good enough.
Do you have a favorite Sid Nathan story?
Sid was now one of the things that I never will forget about him. I know I made a mistake on Sugary. I made on the ending. I made a mistake on it, and I wanted to correct it. I hit one bad note on the end of the song. He just said, "Let it, leave it alone, leave it alone." A perfect record is not going to sell if it ain't not a. He said, "If you make a mistake and it's not too obvious, let it be, because if you make it too perfect, it's not going to sell." That was his philosophy.
I was wondering what Hank Ballard was like, you know, on the road. What was his personality like?
He was good to work for, but sometimes we would miss shows because he would get with a female and knowing that we got to go and do another show, but he would put that first, and that's the only thing I didn't like, because we missed a lot of gigs.
Now, at some point, you had to leave the band. Didn't Uncle Sam call you up?
I got drafted in the Army in 1962, so I was absent out of the group for 2 years. Now, I went to Korea for 13 months and spent the rest of my time in Fort Hood, Texas. Meanwhile, I had talked Hank into hiring, giving Jimi Hendrix a shot, you know, because me and him had been friends from when I first met him in 59. And he gave Jimmy the shot, but Jimmy told me years later, he said, well, you know, Hank Ballard left me stranded. Didn't even pay me. I said, oh, no kidding. I said, oh, man. But he was laughing about it. He didn't really hold grudges and nothing like that.
Well, he eventually hooked up with the Isley Brothers.
Right, right. His biggest problem, I found out what it was. See, Jimmy had a premonition about an early death. And everybody played with fired him because he would interfere with what they done. I mean, he's a side man, but he wants to get up and do his own thing in front of them. And they would fire him, get rid of him. And I was curious about that. And then I found out, I talked to one of his girlfriends, Faye Prison, who girl that he really loved a lot at that time. I asked her, did Jimmy ever express to you that he was going to have an early demise, leave this earth, you know? She said, why you ask? I said, because I could feel it, you know, I could feel this way. She said, well, yeah, he told me that many times that he wasn't going to live long. So I began to put it all together. I said, well, that's why he had the short time to do what he had to do. When he'd get on the stage with the Isley Brothers, Little Richard, something, or Hank Ballard, he'd go on there done. He wants to be discovered so he, because he don't have long to do what he want to do.
Well, after you got out of the Army, you came back to the Midnighters?
Right.
How were things at that point? Because I think that's the mid-60s.
The group was still out there, but it wasn't like it was when I left. And I'll tell you why. In 1961, I think it was, we did a show at the Moulin Rouge in Hollywood, California. Milton Berle was the MC. Count Basie was on the show, the Platters. It was the biggest show that we had ever been on. And Hank Ballard walked off the stage. We started the introduction song. He come out because the bass player had broke my cord accidentally, and he was using Count Basie's bass player, upright bass. So we playing the introduction song, and so Hank comes on stage, and he said, man, why are he playing that bass? I said, well, he broke my cord, and he just grabbed that one and started playing. You know, Hank said, oh, damn this, man. I ain't singing with no upright bass. Then he walked off the stage, and there was a lot of heavyweight people there. And we tried to get him back on the stage for almost 20 minutes. The Platters, Count Basie, everybody talking, Hank, man, this is your chance of a life. But he wouldn't come back on. After that, we never got another hit record. We got something they did okay, but it started going downhill right there. And within, by 1965, the group broke up.
What did you end up doing after the Midnighters broke up?
Well, I came back to Detroit. I started playing with different other people. Mark Reeves and the Vandellas, and I played with a little Johnny Taylor. And I eventually got my own group back together, but just playing locally until I went with Jackie Wilson in 1966.
Weren't you on a bill in the 80s and you ran into another King artist that you knew, James Brown?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, me and James had been friends since the beginning, basically, because he was trying to get me to leave Hank in 1959. Oh, Billy, come on to play with me. You know, I said, James, you know, I play with Hank. I can't leave, you know. He said, man, I'm going to be bigger than Hank. I'm going to be bigger than Jackie Wilson. I'm going to be the biggest thing out here. So I'm just saying to myself, ooh, James lost his mind, you know. And, you know, he did it.
But as I understand, didn't that conversation kind of lead to a reunion of the Midnighters?
Oh, yeah. I was doing a show here in Michigan at a place called Pine Knob. And James was the headliner. Me and him was talking in the dressing room. He said, Billy, when you heard from Hank, you know. I said, James, I ain't heard from Hank in years. I don't know how to find him. I don't know where he at. He said, I got his phone number, you know. So he got his book. He looked up. He thought, yeah, here's Hank's number. He said, write his number down and say, call Hank right there. And said, man, y'all need to get back together, you know. I said, oh, good. And that's how we got back there in the 80s. I called Hank and got together. He formed a new group of Midnighters, and we start touring again around 83, 84.
Down the line, eventually, Hank Ballard got inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and then and not too long ago, the Midnighters got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Right, he got inducted in 1990, and we didn't get inducted until 2012. When Hank got inducted, there were three of us still living, but now there's only two. We knew that we should have been in there with him. We had to wait, and I heard Smokey Robinson was instrumental into getting Midnighters inducted, letting the Rock and Roll Foundation know that the Midnighters deserved to have been into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I got inducted in 2012, and I was the last one. Because the guy that was doing the research, he had left me out totally. Terry Stewart, he was the president of the Rock Hall at the time. He called me and apologized, and he inducted me. I didn't have to go there.
Did you keep in touch with bandmates and Hank over the years?
Oh, yeah, sure did. Hank and I often talked up until, I talked to him about less than 2 months before he passed away.
And was he ill near the end?
He was having problems with his vocal cords because he would get these calls. But we thought it all just from cigarettes, but found out it was cancer. He told me he started smoking when he was about 8 or 9 years old. He was too late, but he was planning on recording. He had a lawsuit against a record company for royalties, and he called me and listened 2 months before he died. Man, when I get my check, you going back in the studio and do some recording? I said, well, man, let me know. You know that I'll always be ready, you know. But the next call I got, I was in my bedroom, and my father come in and told me, said, Billy, said, Hank Ballard dead. That was about less than 2 months before I had talked to him.
Hey, mama, you better talk to Sue. She's doing the hoochie-coochie-coo.
This is Brian Powers. And today we have the great pleasure of speaking with Norman Thrasher, who was one of the Midnighters in Hank Ballard, the Midnighters. And tonight we're going to be talking to him about his experience and his memories of being in that band. Norman, thanks very much for doing this.
Thank you.
Now, as I understand, when I did a little bit of reading, and I think you have a little bit of encounters with the Midnighters before they were the Midnighters, when they were called the Royals. As I understand,
right,
the night that they got signed by Johnny Otis, Johnny Otis was there to check out another band. Can you tell me that story?
Right. Yeah, we were on the amateur show at the Paradise Theater, and we were the Royal Jokers then. And we had won the amateur show the week before. So they were looking for us to come back that night, the next week, and meet Johnny Otis.
Johnny Otis was working for King Records, Federal Records at that time. I think this is 52.
Yes, but he was traveling around the country at that time, although he was working with King Records looking for talent. And he heard the Midnight, which was the Royals, singing in that, because we had sung the week before and had won the amateur show. So we were looking forward to meeting Johnny Otis, and Johnny Otis chose the Royals instead of the Royal Jokers, because we both had the same kind of a name. And that's how that came about.
And the Royals, that was even before Hank Ballard was in the band, right?
My group was the Royal Jokers, and the group that Hank had just started with was the Royals, not the Royals.
Right, there was the five Royals.
They were out of North Carolina. Henry Booth, they were with King Records, too. Henry Booth was Federal, the same as King. Henry Booth was a tenor singer with the Royals. He was formerly with my group, the Royal Jokers. We had been together since he was in elementary school.
So you're part of that scene that was going on in Detroit in the early 50s. What were some of the venues that the local Detroit bands were playing at? What kind of music would I go see if I were to go out?
Same kind of music as rock and roll has today, but we were singing slow songs. Billy Ward and the Dominoes is the first one to come through with Have Mercy Baby, singing a fast song that you could dance by.
That was put out on Federal.
They were the only group that was dancing during that time. I learned how to dance with the Royal Jokers from watching Billy Ward and the Dominoes at the Paradise Theater. Everybody came to the Paradise Theater because that's where we all started at, although we were on amateur shows at the Warfare Theater on Hastings Street. Paradise Theater was a major venue because there wasn't no whites trying to get into the music industry.
So there was a little label that was in Detroit at that time, but was there much of a recording going on in Detroit?
A lot of recording, but nothing was happening. They had a lot of the entertainers that were recording were trying to get on black radio, and the white ones were automatically on CKLW on the white radio stations. So we didn't listen to them.
So you were in some of these other local bands in Detroit. How did you end up being with the Midnighters? Because that was a couple years later, I think.
Well, I was with the Royal Jokers, and we had a hit record out, You Tickle Me Baby. We were at the Flame Show Bar, and Henry Booth, who used to be with us, came by to see our show at the Flame. That's where Maurice King was, that was later on the music director for the Spinners. And Maurice King had a band at the Flame Show Bar. Henry came by and told me that they needed a road manager and asked me would I come out there on the road with them. So I said, yeah, I'll come out there. And so I left my group at the Flame Show Bar and went on the road with the Midnighters the next day. And Sonny Woods was the bass singer. So we were in Indianapolis, Indiana, and got to the town early. We were at the job at 8 o'clock, 8:30. Midnight was supposed to go on the stage at 9. Otherwise, they would fine them, dock them their money. Sonny Woods never did show up, so Hank told me to say, Norman, you better put on Sonny's uniform so we can get that money. So Sonny was a bit larger than myself. So I wrapped the belt around my waist and went on and started dancing that night with the Midnighters and never took the uniform off.
Then they were kind of known for doing a lot of dance moves, right? You guys had coordinated.
Yeah, I started into dancing.
Did you already know all the dance moves since you had been the road manager?
I watched their show. I knew all their music because I was with them about 2 months before we went to Indianapolis, Indiana. So by me being in show business, I knew all the steps and so forth. So it was easy for me.
At that time, the Midnighters had already had some of those Annie songs that were hits.
Annie had a baby. Work with me, Annie. Sexy Ways.
Work with me, Annie. Work with me, Annie. Ooh, work with me, Annie. Work with me, Annie. Work with me, Annie. Let's get it while the getting is good.
So good, so good, so good, so good.
And were those so big crowd pleasers when you joined the band?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, they were bigger than ever. We worked 24 days a month out of 30.
What kind of venues were you playing at?
Smoking joints, nightclubs, you know, different halls where only African-Americans could play during those years, you know.
I guess you were part of the Chitlin Circuit.
Right, that's all it was. They called it the Chitlin Circuit, but the only time white started really coming to the job is when we played in Macon, Georgia, and we played Atlanta with the twist. We're the one that taught the rich people how to do the twist in Atlanta, the Dinklers.
So can you tell me a little bit about the story about how the twist was written and recorded?
Well, no more than Hank became owner of the song, you know, and we went straight into Cincinnati and recorded it. Henry Glover was the producer, Ralph Bass and Henry.
Right, and I think Henry Glover did a lot of your guys' sessions, right?
Yeah. Ralph Bass was with the Midnighters the most of the time. Ralph was a white boy that had black feeling.
Can you tell me about your guitar player, Cal Green?
Yeah, Cal was an excellent, you know, personality. And he was short, but he was very clean cut. And he could play that guitar. He had a Gibson, and he could play it. Sometimes it sounded like an organ, but he could play that guitar.
I think he actually did some solo work under his name at King, didn't he?
Right, before he died, yeah. He was out in California.
Didn't he get into some trouble when you guys were on the road? He got arrested?
Yeah, he got arrested because everybody was smoking reefer. And the police heard, we were in Houston, Texas, and the police heard that we were reefer smokers. And we were going with a couple of policemen's girlfriends. So they came by the motel, you know, and had a warrant to search our van and everything to see if we had any reefer. And Lawson had some seeds in a coke, and Cal had some seeds, and they put them in jail. Them having some seeds, no reefer. It was seeds from the reefer. Give them 2 years in Huntsville, Texas, on the farm.
Yes, the search is all over. I found my one and only love.
So you lost your guitar player, and I think that's how you got Billy Davis, right?
Right.
Well, one of the things I heard about the twist was it got really popular with kids in Baltimore, and you guys played like a few days at the Royal Theater in Baltimore.
Yeah, played a week at the Royal, week in Philly, week in Washington. Those theaters were carrying weeks, a week at the Apollo.
Do you have a memory of when you started noticing people were actually dancing to the twist?
Oh, yeah, when we first started singing it. Because we were doing it. It was a happy song. They danced to it today, same as they did then. I sing the Twist right today, and people dance to it like they did 50 years ago.
Do you remember the day when you heard the Chubby Checker version of the Twist?
Yeah, we were in Miami, Florida, and Hank was listening to the pop radio station to see if we were going to get any airplay on there. And Dick Clark wanted the managers. We did a Twist on his show, and he wanted the managers, and Hank turned him down. That's when he found Chubby at the fish market and asked him, could he sing? And Chubby said, yeah, and then the rest is history. They did a Twist identical to us. That's why Hank thought it was the Midnighters on the pop station in Miami, Florida, when he heard it, and it was Chubby Checker.
Now, you guys had a couple hits in 1960, right? You had The Twist was a hit for you guys.
Finger
you...
Poppin' Time, Let's Go, Thrill on the Hill.
Yeah, I think you had three songs that were on the pop charts at the same time.
Yeah, we were a hot group for 10 years.
And with Finger Poppin' Time, do you ever hear of a story how that song came about, how that was written?
I never thought about it. When they ain't come up with the song, we go in the studio and just record it.
Did you have any encounters with Sid Nathan, the owner of King Records?
Sid would always say he didn't have no money. He would send us up on Ross Avenue and get a Cadillac out the window. We'd go up there and pick out a new Cadillac and drive on off. Sid had already called him and told him that he would take the bill. The Cadillac wasn't about $3,000. The record sold $100,000, made $100,000. But he would give Hank money. He wouldn't get a group none of that money. He'd give Hank $5,000, $10,000. Hank bought it for his house from that money, from the Twist. We didn't get a nickel. And then after Sid died, I had a couple of records out on my label on Lois Publishing, and he called in and he told me, I told him who I was, and I hadn't heard from Lois Publishing. He told me, well, you ain't going to hear from them. All that money that was still made from Lois Publishing. That's when the Midnighters, we were playing in Macon, Georgia, and Little Richard, before he got famous, he used to come to the Macon Auditorium. James Brown, when he got out of jail, Bobby Bird brought him by. We met both of them the same night. And Little Richard and James Brown had been my friends from that time on.
Well, I think the Midnighters were a big influence on James Brown.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Hank took him to see Nathan.
What was Hank Ballard like to work for?
He was a decent fellow. He just got greedy. We were splitting up the money for a while. Then he got greedy and wanted more of it because he was the lead singer.
Well, I guess you were there when you were the Midnighters, and then you became Hank Ballard in the Midnighters.
Right, right. Sid Nathan did that because of the Twist.
You were there, I guess, when Hank was trying to get off King in like 58, right? When he went down to Florida and recorded with Henry Stone.
That's where we recorded Twist at first, with Henry Stone. Sid found out about it, and because we had about another 3 weeks on the label, on the contract. Sid heard about it because Henry Stone wanted to be honest about it and called Sid Nathan and told me he recorded us. Sid Nathan said, well, let me hear what you did. And Sid Nathan found out that it was a smash record, and he picked up the option. And we never did go back to Henry Stone. Henry Stone was sending the master.
Weren't you guys showing up on some TV shows with Finger Poppin' Time and Let's Go, Let's Go?
Yeah, we did the Mike Douglas show.
Well, I know you guys had the Twist dance, but then you guys were doing a lot of other dances too, right? You did the
Hoochie Coochie. Come on, baby, let's do the Hoochie Coochie and Switcheroo.
And there was the Float and the Continental Walk, I think.
Continental Walk, yeah. They call it the Applejack, Continental Walk.
You've seen a new look, and you've heard a new sound. Now the Continental Walk is in your town. Let's do the Continental Walk. Get up, everybody, and let's walk, walk, walk. Ooh, oh. Let's do the Continental Walk. Come on, everybody, now, and let's walk. Walk.
Now, as I understand it, Hank Ballard wasn't that very good of a dancer, that it was really you guys.
He didn't dance at all. Just Lawson, Henry, and myself.
So can you talk about how you guys worked out your dance moves?
Yeah, we did it on the stage. New song, new record. You know, we come up with something on the stage. We never did rehearse. Come up with a dance on the stage and liked it, a routine on the stage and liked it. We just kept it.
Well, you guys were like dancing and doing backup singing at the same time, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's a bit of a workout, isn't it?
No, it wasn't nothing. It was just what we did.
Did you have a certain dance that you liked over other dances?
No. All of them were the same. When we get to a break in a song, I break out and go to dancing. A lot of groups had routines, you know, in the breaks. But we would dance separately, each one of us. Lawson would dance, Henry would dance, and I would dance. I'd jump off the stage, dance up the aisle, and come back to the stage by the time the solo was over.
And how would you guys dress as the Midnighters?
Suits, shirt and tie. Kraft Brothers used to make our clothes in New York.
Did you have to have several suits? I mean, I would think you'd be sweating every night.
Oh, yeah. We had 10 suits apiece.
Did you keep any of those uniforms?
No. Because we broke up. We just left New York and got on an airplane and went to Atlanta. We left everything. Just got on the airplane and left.
Leaving the Midnighters, you mean?
Yeah.
What happened?
I ain't wanted all the money. Greedy. Got greedy.
What happened? Did you guys were going to do a show and then you weren't getting the money and you guys just walked?
No, we talked about it. We wanted more of that money. You know, we make it a whole lot. We make $4,000 or $5,000 a night back then. $6,000, $7,000. You know, and Hank wanted the bulk of the money. We had our own bus, you know, own bus driver, valet, and band. We had our own band.
Yeah, Billy said that you guys would travel by 2 Cadillacs, I think.
Yeah, that was in the early days. When the Isley Brothers come out, we had Cadillacs when they first come out. But then we bought a bus. We bought Bill Jolker's first bus.
So that must have been an upgrade in travel.
Oh, yeah.
But I would think it would be pretty grueling. You guys did a lot of shows, a lot of traveling. Wouldn't that get pretty...
Yeah, it didn't bother us. Yeah, we traveled 300-400 miles at night and do a show the next day.
Now, when you had like those pop hits like in 1960, was your audience changing? I mean, I would think you guys in the 50s were mostly a black audience. Were you getting more a white audience coming
more
to your
show? Yeah, the Twist brought on more white audience. The Twist and Finger Popping Time.
Did your venues that you played at, did that change at all?
It was still called the Chicken Circuit because we were black artists. And so whites would come to the black venues. They were nice venues. They weren't horrible places. They hold 3,000 or 4,000 people.
Didn't you write some songs when you were with the Midnighters?
Yeah. I wrote Keep Up My Heart. Was one of the last songs that they put out with one of the Midnighter songs. That's why King Records told me that I wasn't going to never hear from the publisher. I haven't heard from them. Hadn't made a dime.
So when did you leave the Midnighters? Was that like maybe 63 or something?
Yeah. All three of us left at the same time. Went to Atlanta. Lawson was going with a school teacher in Atlanta, and I had met one, and Henry went to California. Henry went to Oakland.
So did you continue doing music?
I did, but Lawson didn't. Lawson quit. I'm still doing it.
So, yeah, so can you talk a little bit about that? What were some of the projects that you worked on?
Well, Joe Louis started a record company out in California. You know, and I was the first artist on the record company with Gerald Wilson in the big band. Thing called Never Look Back. Nat King Cole picked it out, you know.
Did you keep in touch with any of the Midnighters or Hank Ballard or anything over the years?
No. But I saw Hank during the latter days after we got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You know, he even went in there by himself because just being greedy. He didn't do no dancing and he didn't do no background singing, you know. But he suffered after all because he got sick. Lawson and I both came to his rescue.
Oh, really? How's that?
By letting him know we were inducted into the Doo-Wop Hall of Fame there in New Jersey. And Hank was there and he couldn't hardly catch his breath. You know, so we consoled him while we were there.
Was it Hank Battle and the Midnighters got inducted
right.
into the doo-wop?
And the Rock and Roll.
Well, I was going to say, finally, you got recognized by the Rock Hall just a few years ago, right?
Right, at 2012.
And you were at the ceremony, right?
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about that experience?
You know, it was a wonderful experience. They treated us extremely well, you know. Smokey inducted us in. I've been knowing Smokey since he was a youngster, so it was a beautiful event. I did the speech, you know, and Lawson and I were standing there on the stage, you know.
Is it just you and Billy Davis who's left of the Midnighters at this point?
Yeah, me and Billy. Well, Lawson died early last year.
When you think about the Midnighters, what do you think back about those days?
Nothing. I got pictures on everything and plaques and still sing, so I don't think nothing about it. I still sing some of the Midnighter songs.
You're still performing? You're still out there dancing and singing?
For one reason, because I didn't get old. I'm old, but I don't look old. They don't consider me as a oldie but goodie.
And I was curious, when you guys would be recording, did you usually have material ready when you went in to record, or did you try to work out arrangements?
No, we worked it all out in the studio. We had our own band, so they went in the studio and they put a chart, and Henry Glover would write a chart out. All our band could read music, you know, because they really come out of the jazz field, playing rhythm and blues. A couple of our people come out of Ray Charles' band.
Who were some of the musicians that you guys had recording with you guys?
Pat Patterson, Hank Moore. Pat Patterson played trumpet. Hank Moore played tenor. And one of the people from Ray Charles' band played alto. We had Laverne Hastings was playing bass. He come from the Etta James group. So we had all top people.
I had a couple of questions about Henry Glover. What was his demeanor like on your recording sessions?
Soft, kind man. Everybody was kind to us.
Was Ralph Bass, was he...
He looked like Paladin on TV. Remember Cowboy?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, that's what Ralph Bass looked just like him. So everybody respected the Midnighters extremely well, because we were clean-cut people. Nobody had an attitude.
I mean, you guys worked pretty fast on your recordings, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. We'd go in and learn the song and come out of there in about 6-7 hours. Next day, the record be on the street. Or they would master the record, you know, mix it, master it, and press it right there at King Records. The pressing plant was right there at the studio. After you record, they leave out of one room, and they take the master in another room and mix it down, then take it in another room and master it, then take it out of there into the pressing plant. See, Nathan had it all working out.
What did you get from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? Did you get, like, a plaque, and where do you put it?
On my wall. It's a statue, really. A statue with a record on top. Got a jacket and a cap. But it's the most famous event that we were ever recognized by, and that was the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Rock and roll is everywhere around the world.
So when you look back on your career, I mean, what are you most proud of?
Everything. My whole life has been successful. I'm 84 now. I don't look like I'm 84. I don't talk like I'm 84. I don't act like I'm 84. So it's still a blessing for me.
Come on, come on, come on, come on. It's twisting, twist, twisting time. Twisting time. Twisting time. I feel so twisted until I'm out of my mind. Come and twist with me. Pretty, pretty, pretty baby. Come and twist with me.
Thanks for listening to this special about Hank Ballard and the Midnighters in honor of Cincinnati's celebration of King Records Month in September. I'd like to thank music historian Brian Powers, as well as Andy Balterman and Elaine Spears for their technical support. You'll find a link to more information about Hank Ballard and the Midnighters, as well as the many King Records events the rest of this month at WBXU.org. I'm Lee Hay, and you're listening to 91.7 WBXU Cincinnati and 88.5 WMUB Oxford.